This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Keri Phillips.
The Country Party, founded by Sir Earl Page, announced today that it will change its name to the National Country Party of Australia.
We're endeavouring to broaden the base to try to get away from the concept that so many people have in their minds that the Country Party is a narrow sectional party which merely looks after the interests of farmers.
Whatever you call it, Country Party or the Nationals, it's now Australia's second oldest political party and has been a significant player for the better part of a century. With possibly around 12 months to go until the next federal election, party leader and Deputy Prime Minister Mark Vaile recently resigned as Minister for Trade, taking up a portfolio that would allow him to spend more time in Australia, where he can work to improve the Nationals' electoral chances. But can he arrest the party's decline? In the last three federal elections, the National Party has recorded its three lowest shares of the vote and two lowest shares of seats. Today on Rear Vision, a history of this venerable party and a look at some of the reasons for its decline. Professor Don Aitken, academic and former Vice-Chancellor of the University of Canberra, has studied and written extensively about the Country Party and rural politics in Australia. He says that the roots of the party lie in the economic realities of farming in Australia.
The thing that's different about Australia, compared with the European countries from which most of us are descended, is that in those countries, farmers grow for a local market. In the new countries, like Australia and Canada and the Argentine, farmers grew for a market a long way away. That's the real difference, and that's the reason that the party came into existence. Because, to use the current phrase, or it's a very old phrase really, we're price takers, not price setters. Australian farmers have to accept the price for their product that is set by the world. In other words, it's got to be the lowest price landed in Britain or wherever. And that means that they've got no control over their price, they only have control over their costs, and a lot of their costs were set by government. And so farmers began to try and influence government to reduce their costs. They did that in Canada, they did it in the Argentine, and they did it in Australia and New Zealand.
Professor Brian Costa is a political scientist at Swinburne University of Technology, where he specialises in Australian political parties, parliamentary politics and Australian electoral history. He says that it's generally held that the party was formed in Western Australia in 1913, although precise dates are still the subject of arguments in country pubs. By 1920, there were identifiably country parties in the federal and in all the state parliaments.
The state that in modern times is associated with the National Party, the Country Party's successor, is Queensland. But Queensland was the slowest state to get off the ground in terms of forming a country party. There were a couple of reasons for that. One was the absence of a wheat industry. If there's any common factor in the formation of the country parties across the states, it was the growing of wheat. They were the areas where you tended to get strong country parties. So in Western Australia, you have a wheat belt there east of Perth, and there's where you got what were originally called farmers and settlers associations, which then morphed into political parties. And similarly in South Australia, where you had wheat areas. New South Wales was the interestingly different one, in that in New South Wales, wealthier graziers tended to join the country party, whereas by contrast in Victoria, wealthy graziers in the Western District tended to retain their nationalist party identities and alliances, which made the Victorian Country Party the radical agrarian populist party of the 1920s and 30s. In Tasmania, a state where you'd think a country party would flourish because it's more rural, less dominated by the capital city, there's great ironies there. The first federal leader of the Country Party was a Tasmanian, Bill McWilliams, but the party died out there very quickly. And the reason given is that the Labor and Nationalist parties, as the Liberals were called in those days, were themselves very agrarian, and there was no niche for the Country Party to maintain. And really, the Country Party pretty well had expired in Tasmania by the 1930s.
Earl Page was elected to the federal parliament in 1919, winning Cowper, a seat he went on to hold for 42 years. He was involved in the establishment of the Country Party in 1920, becoming its parliamentary leader. He negotiated a coalition with the Nationalists, as the Liberals were then called, in 1923, and served as Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer in the Bruce government until 1929.
I think the Country Party had one great advantage. It fortuitously, in my view, found extremely able leaders. The most able of them all and the most under-regarded politician in Australian history is Earl Page. And he was extraordinarily good at politics, probably the best politician in a kind of professional way that Australia's ever seen. And the reason I say that is because all the things that he did are still there. For example, he founded the Federal Coalition. The Federal Coalition is alive and well 83 years after he founded it. He founded the first National Health Scheme, 1956. He started the Loan Council, which is still an important part of our financing. He was the first minister to use the Constitution to provide grants to the states under terms that the Commonwealth would decide. And that's a fundamental way in which the Howard government today passes out money to the states. And he was the first federal minister to call the state ministers in an area together and nut out a piece of cooperative federalism. And that's still done. That's absolutely the way we do things today. Earl Page was an extraordinarily able politician. And the paradox is that almost everything that he did increased the power of the Commonwealth, which was actually not what he was about. He was a federalist who wanted to see more power go to local areas and to, if it had to be the states, but he would actually have liked new states and more of them.
Brian Costa says that during the 20s and 30s, wheat was the issue that galvanised the Country Party movement, bringing them into conflict with their coalition partners, the Nationalists.
Wheat farming at that stage tended to be smaller holdings, whereas, of course, the pastoralists were running large sheep and cattle stations. And, of course, a lot of the wheat-growing areas were drought-prone, and price fluctuations were a real problem in the wheat industry. This is where, of course, there's a connection with the controversies about AWB and single-desk marketing. The wheat farmers became politically active in trying to sustain the compulsory wheat pool that was established by the government of Billy Hughes during the First World War as a war measure. That is, that you had a single government body which bought wheat from the wheat growers at a fixed price and then on sold it both onto the domestic and, of course, into the British market. Now, that was a war measure, and it expired after the war ended. And wheat growers were very much opposed to the expiration of this and fought in the state and federal parliaments right through the 1920s in order to achieve it. It really wasn't achieved. There were fits and starts about it. There were voluntary wheat marketing schemes. There were attempts at compulsory wheat marketing. There were arguments about whether it was constitutional for states to do it and so on. This sort of turbulence, if you like, kept up a political interest amongst particularly wheat farmers and brought them into conflict, ironically, not so much with the Labor Party, which was more favourable to compulsory marketing, but the Country Party and wheat farmers clashed heavily in various states with Nationalist Party politicians who, of course, were more attuned to what they called free enterprise and were in favour of having private wheat merchants operating on the market, whereas wheat farmers were opposed to that because they thought that the wheat merchants used to play them off one against the other and reduce their prices.
Despite the fact that the Country Party has, at a federal level, always been the minority partner in coalition governments, it's managed to exert greater influence than you might expect. No one was able to manipulate the influence of the Country Party more, perhaps, than John McEwen.
When one with legitimate ambitions comes into politics, of course there's a hankering to be Prime Minister. But I've faced up to this and realised, and accepted it, I should say, that as a member of the Country Party, the Prime Ministership is not within one's grasp.
Yes, I suppose McEwen would have to qualify as the most significant leader they had. He was a very interesting character, of course. As Paul Hasluck said in his memoirs, that McEwen was the executive man of the Menzies governments. In other words, McEwen was the hard worker. And it was that hard work that he did, particularly in the portfolio of trade and his other portfolio of industry, that he really, if you like, exercised influence over the government. It wasn't so much that he was the leader of the minor coalition party. As he said himself, you never got anywhere in the cabinet by threatening to walk out of the coalition every time you didn't get your own way. His view was that you just simply had to work at it, and he used his status, in a sense, of being the hard worker of that government, being the Deputy Prime Minister, and being the Trade Minister in that post-war period.
John McEwen I actually met and knew and talked with. I think he is in many ways one of the most powerful politicians of the second half of the 20th century. He did a lot of very good things. One of the things he did, which cost him a lot of support, was to say the war with Japan is over. Japan and we have complementary economic interests, and I will do my best to make sure that they are realised. And of course, Japan became very quickly one of our major trading partners, and it still is. He tried to hang on to protection longer than I think was probably sensible. He was a very upright man, a very tough man.
And he was tough enough to stop William McMahon becoming Prime Minister after Harold Holt disappeared in the surf in 1967 by threatening to take the Country Party out of the coalition. This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Keri Phillips, and today we're looking at the history of Australia's country party, the Nationals. The survival of a party representing rural interests into the 21st century in Australia reflects the successful maintenance of the coalition of the two parties, now known as the Liberals and the Nationals. Paul Davey, who worked for more than 20 years at senior levels within the National Country Party and is the author of a history called The Nationals, says that as a coalition partner, the party managed to do a lot for country people.
Roads, railways, education, schooling. I mean, the Country Party was absolutely responsible for setting up the University of New England. David Drummond did that partly when he was in the New South Wales Parliament as Education Minister, and then federally when he went on down there. The party had an enormous impact on the development of country education and tertiary education, not just schools. Charlie Cutler in New South Wales in 1962 was the guy who first raised the idea of state aid for independent schools. Bob Askin and the Liberal Party in New South Wales were a bit hesitant about this. They didn't like it too much. But then the federal coalition decided that they'd be prepared to spend money on science blocks for independent schools, and that eased the tension a bit for Askin, so the Liberals sort of came on board. Charlie Cutler always said that the feds might claim credit for state aid for independent schools, but it was really us and the New South Wales Country Party. And that was a very significant thing.
I think if you take it over the long term and take into account what other strategies were available to them, that is to the Country Party, I think it has been quite successful, because had it not been coalition, it would have been nothing. The Federal Party never had the luxury that the Country Party in Victoria had in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even early 1950s, in which they formed, admittedly, minority governments, but they could form governments in their own right. And of course, later in the 1980s, it happened in Queensland. But at the federal level, the Country Party numerical support in the parliament was never high enough, really, for them to pursue a go-it-alone strategy. And because the Labor Party at the federal level was not keen to support minority governments, really it was either a coalition or the party would just have to sit on the crossbenches and lobby for individual proposals, which probably wouldn't have worked. Now, I know that's quite controversial. There are people in the National Party today who will say that the Country Party sold itself out by linking up with the Liberal Party, who didn't always follow Country Party policy. That, in a sense, is true. The party did suffer some defeats at various points along the way. But the big question is, well, what was the alternative? And would that alternative have delivered anything really of substance to rural Australia? Probably not. And what it probably would have done would have terminated the Country Party, because what would have happened is, I'm sure, that the Liberal Party and the Labor Party would have put forward the argument of, why vote for the Country Party? They're just sitting in the corner. They can't form governments. Vote for us. And I think probably what would have happened is that the Country Party would have died out a long time ago.
Despite their enduring coalition, there's always been vigorous competition between the two parties for seats.
Generally, there were full-on three-cornered contests in most of the states where the National Party was relevant. At various times, you'd get arrangements where they'd enter into sort of unofficial agreements not to oppose each other's ministers. But there were a number of occasions in which Robert Menzies had to attend state council meetings of the Liberal Party in Victoria to convince them not to run Liberal candidates against John McEwen. And McEwen would encourage the Country Party to run candidates against Liberals. McEwen there was an interesting character in that he would happily sit in Cabinet and agree to policy decisions, which he would then go out to state conferences of the Country Party and attack. How he got away with that, of course, is going back to the thing is that Menzies needed him because he was the most competent minister in the government. But yes, that electoral competition has been a fact of life almost since the day the Country Party was formed, which is why, remember, we got preferential voting. The Hughes government introduced preferential voting to prevent a situation arising where the Country Party and you'd have a Nationalist and a Labor candidate in a seat, and the Country Party and the Nationalists would split the anti-Labor vote, and because it was first-past-the-post voting, Labor could win it. So that, in a sense, the vigorous competition between the Liberal, as it's now called, and the National Party, as it's now called, gave us preferential voting.
The disastrous Joe for Canberra campaign in 1987 is regarded by many as the beginning of the serious decline of the National Party.
More than 3,000 people attended the Albury rally. Such gatherings have become a feature of Sir Joe's push towards Canberra since he launched his campaign 8 weeks ago in the nearby city of Wagga Wagga. The Queensland Premier savagely attacked the Liberal leader, Mr Howard, and Nationals leader, Mr Sinclair, saying they did not deserve a second chance in government. He said his hand-picked candidates would receive wide community support, and he'll relinquish his Queensland job to ensure he's elected to federal parliament.
I'm going to walk out on being Premier of the best state of Australia. The salary, office, and all that goes with it, my jet, the cars and everything. I have no superannuation. I'm going out on the street to contest a new election.
Well, the Queensland National Party has never got over it, and it caused terrible problems for the federal coalition. I mean, the federal coalition was split. Arguably, it helped cost John Howard the prime ministership in 1987. Bjelke Petersen was an interesting National Party politician in the sense that, yes, he was a farmer, but he was very wealthy through all sorts of development schemes that he entered into while he was a farmer. But he became the darling, of course, of a very rapidly growing business sector in southeast Queensland. I mean, the rate of population growth in Queensland from the 1970s onwards was quite phenomenal, and of course it's still going. Now, what happened there is that people moved into Queensland who might otherwise have been Liberal voters, but because, for historical reasons, the National Party was the senior member in the coalition there, they tended to gravitate to the National Party because the National Party was blatantly pro-business. Various business interests got into Bjelke Petersen's ear and convinced him that he could be the saviour of non-Labor politics in Australia if only he moved to Canberra. So then we got that announcement that he was going to, in a sense, become not just a federal politician, but he was going to produce a new political party, some sort of an amalgamation of the Liberals and the Nationals, and that he was going to lead them to glory. Now, at the time, anyone who sat down and did the electoral sums could see that this was never going to happen. But the media took to it with great enthusiasm and followed him around all around the place. But, of course, the minute that the whole Joe for Canberra matter was put to electoral tests, both in the Northern Territory and in a by-election in Victoria, it showed that it had little or no support. So Bjelke Petersen then backs out. And, of course, that was a disaster, because having built up the expectation and then to say, well, look, I'm not going to do it and I'm not even going to run for federal politics was devastating. And, of course, that had a traumatic effect on the National Party in Queensland, from which it has not really yet recovered.
That debacle was followed by a leadership challenge to the federal leader Ian Sinclair, whose career had been damaged earlier by allegations of forgery in relation to his father's will, although he had been acquitted.
The party room in Canberra did eventually roll Ian Sinclair. He's the first federal leader in the party's history to have been rolled by his party room. That was in 1987. 89. Around the same time, you had the emerging results of the Fitzgerald inquiry into corruption in Queensland, and that had a major impact on the Queensland Party. In New South Wales, you had the state leader, Wal Murray, and a couple of his ministers up before ICAC over rorting allegations on the on land development in the far north coast. It really hurt Wal Murray. He never got over that. What I'm saying is that there was this sort of culmination of these events, which, when you pull them together, they upset the party faithful. Country Party members, National Party members tend to be honest, conservative-minded people, and when they saw their party getting into this sort of mess all over the place. And after Sinclair was rolled, Charles Blunt took over the leadership, and then he lost his seat. And then after he'd lost his seat, there was a controversy over his use of postage stamp entitlements. That was another thing, another little nail in all these sort of rows. That caused damage. Members left. Members didn't re-sign. They didn't rejoin. And, there's no doubt that caused a big damage to the party, which it is only really in the last 3 to 5 years started to get over.
Will that be enough? The growing resentment of rural voters was expressed by support of not only One Nation candidates in the late 90s, but also independents and even the Labour Party, which enjoyed a big rural swing in Victoria. Don Aitken says the decline of the party is inevitable.
One reason is that increasingly over the 20th century, and this is a really important thing to remember about the last 100 years, is that at the beginning of the 20th century, the 1911 census from memory, the rural workforce was one-third of the entire workforce. The rural workers were one-third of all workers. Today they're about 1%. And the decline just went on and on and on and on. And now the 14 largest urban areas in Australia contain 94% of all Australians. So the number of people we're talking about out in the bush, rural and regional Australia, is only 6% of the whole. And most of those live in towns, smaller towns. So the number of people actually living on farms is now a microscopic part of the whole of Australia. When a third of the workforce lived in the country, you had a lot more country electorates. Now we have very few, and they are increasingly urban in that, for example, if you take Richmond, which was Doug Anthony's, that's not any longer a banana farmer, pineapple farmer, dairy farmer seat at all. It's basically based around Lismore, which is a big city in the area, which has a university. It's got the usual raft of things that large country cities have, and it's affected mostly by them, not by the farmers.
I think it's only partly an explanation, because if you took the demographic argument, then the party again should have expired years ago. I mean, it has a political dynamic as well. At the federal level, at least, the party hasn't been managing this political dynamic as well as they could. If you look at the electoral map, there are plenty of electorates in regional and rural Australia that could be won by the National Party. Now, my argument is it's not so much that the National Party's voters have up and left the electorates. It's just that they've up and left the National Party. So you get a situation where the party's losing seats to Liberals, sometimes in northern New South Wales losing them to Labor, and of course in three seats now losing them effectively to independents. Now, I think that's a political issue. It's not so much a demographic issue. The party could almost double its representation if you just looked at seats that were winnable. For example, the seat in Australia that has the second highest percentage of people engaged in what's called agribusiness is the seat of O'Connor in Western Australia, which for years has been held by a Liberal, Wilson Tuckey. Now, why is it that the seat of Maranoa in Queensland, which is the seat that has the highest proportion of people working in agribusiness, is National Party, yet the almost equivalent seat in Western Australia is held by a Liberal? So that's my point. There are seats there to be won. It's just you've got to get out there and win them.
And Brian Costa predicts that the Nationals will maintain 12 seats at the next federal election, with the possibility of taking one more from Labor. John Jacobs is the technical producer for Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye till next time.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. and we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.